callback.
Station on the ground reporting. News, Ozzy Harper. Yeah! Here I am, your main man, reporting from Jam Jam. On 16,000 kilocycles FM, and 1,000 megahertz on the ground.
This is Simon Shaheen. You are listening to WGXC Accra 90.7 FM.
You like music?
This is Andy, host of Crawl Out from the Fallout with Raven Sings the Blues right here on WGXC. The show is a monthly roundup of new offerings from the worlds of psych, indie, jangle pop, experimental music, and folk, bolstered with enough classic fodder to make them stick.
That's what I'm talking about, man.
Tune in to Crawl Out from the Fallout every second Tuesday of the month from 8 to 10 p.m. right here on WGXC 90.7 FM.
How can you say no to that?
WGXC underwriting is provided in part by the Dreammaker Collective, a local collective located in the Tin Barn in Claremont, New York, hosting many different kinds of public and private events, including dance parties, flea markets, and karaoke night. You can find the Dreammaker Collective on Instagram and Facebook, or by phone at 518-821-5708, or email at dreammakercollective@gmail.com.
Wave Farms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous support of Ralph Gartner of Valencia, New York. WGXC supporters.
Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, friends and enemies, you're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM in the beautiful Hudson Valley, Hudson, Catskill, Accra, New York. WGXC.org on the World Wide Web. I'm your host, Norman Douglas. Name of the show, Good Night, Norman. It is the 17th day of March. In the year 2025 of the Christian era. An era proclaimed by Christians, of course, not by Christ. That would be St. Patrick's Day in some parts of the world. St. Patrick's Day. The day that the Irish apparently celebrate their Hitler, St. Patrick, the man who sold the pagans into slavery or put them to death for the Church of England. I guess that's a good reason to drink green beer until your face planted. In any case, I'm going to read some fiction. This is an old tale. A classic of the 20th century, The Garden of Forking Paths by Jorge Luis Borges. In his A History of the World War on page 212, Captain Lydell Hart reports that a planned offensive by 13 British divisions supported by 1,400 artillery pieces against the German line at Serre Montauban, scheduled for July 24, 1916, had to be postponed until the morning of the 29th. He comments that torrential rain caused this delay, which lacked any special significance. The following deposition, dictated by, read over, and then signed by Dr. Yu Tsun, former teacher of English at the Jingzhou Hochschule, casts unsuspected light upon this event. The first two pages are missing. Thereafter it continues. And I hung up the phone. Immediately I recollected the voice that had spoken in German. It was that of Captain Richard Madden. Madden in Victor Runenberg's office meant the end of all our work, and though this seemed a secondary matter, or should have seemed to me, of our lives also. His being there meant that Runenberg had been arrested or murdered. Before the sun set on this same day, I ran the same risk. Madden was implacable. Rather, to be more accurate, he was obliged to be implacable. An Irishman in the service of England, a man suspected of equivocal feelings, if not of actual treachery, how could he fail to welcome and seize upon this extraordinary piece of luck, the discovery, capture, and perhaps the deaths of two agents of Imperial Germany? Whoa. I went up to my bedroom. Absurd though the gesture was, I closed and locked the door. I threw myself down on my narrow iron bed and waited on my back. The never-changing rooftops filled the window, and the hazy 6 o'clock sun hung in the sky. It seemed incredible that this day, a day without warnings or omens, might be that of my implacable death. In despite of my dead father, in despite of having been a child in one of the symmetrical gardens of Haifeng, was I to die now? Then I reflected that all things happen to one, precisely now. Century follows century, and things happen only in the present. There are countless men in the air, on land, and at sea, and all that really happens to me. The almost unbearable memory of Madden's long horse face put an end to these wandering thoughts. In the midst of my hatred and terror, now that it no longer matters to me to speak of terror, now that I've outwitted Richard Madden, now that my neck hankers for the hangman's noose, I knew that the fast-moving and doubtless happy soldier did not suspect that I possessed the secret, the name of the exact site of the new British artillery park on the Ancre. A bird streaked across the misty sky, and absently I turned it into an airplane, and then that airplane into many in the skies of France, shattering the artillery park under a rain of bombs. If only my mouth, before it should be silenced by a bullet, could shout this name in such a way that it could be heard in Germany, my voice, my human voice, was weak. How could it reach the ear of the chief, the ear of that sick and hateful man who knew nothing of Runenberg or of me, except that we were in Staffordshire? A man who, sitting in his arid Berlin office, leafed infinitely through newspapers, looking in vain for news from us. I said aloud, I must flee. I sat up on the bed, in senseless and perfect silence, as if Madden was already peering at me. Something, perhaps merely a desire to prove my total penury to myself, made me empty out my pockets. I found just what I knew I was going to find. The American watch, the nickel-plated chain, and the square coin. The key ring, with the useless but compromising keys to Runeberg's office. The notebook. A letter which I decided to destroy at once, and which I did not destroy. A 5-shilling piece, 2 single shillings, and some pennies, a red and blue pencil, a handkerchief, and a revolver with a single bullet. Absurdly, I held it and waited in my hand to give myself courage. Vaguely, I thought that a pistol shot can be heard for a great distance. In 10 minutes, I had developed my plan. The telephone directory gave me the name of the one person capable of passing on the information. He lived in a suburb of Fenton, less than 30 minutes away by train. I am a timorous man. I can say it now. Now that I have brought my incredibly risky plan to an end, it was not easy to bring about, and I know that its execution was terrible. I did not do it for Germany, no. Such a barbarous country is of no importance to me, particularly since it had degraded me by making me become a spy. Furthermore, I knew an Englishman, a modest man who for me is as great as Goethe. I did not speak with him for more than 1 hour, but during that time he was Goethe. I carried out my plan because I felt the chief had some fear of those of my race, of those uncountable forebears whose culmination lies in me. I wished to prove to him that a yellow man could save his armies. Besides, I had to escape the captain. His hands and voice could, at any moment, knock and beckon at my door. Silently I dressed, took leave of myself in the mirror, went down the stairs, sneaked a look at the quiet street, and went out. The station was not far from my house, but I thought it more prudent to take a cab. I told myself that I thus ran less chance of being recognized. The truth is that in the deserted street I felt infinitely visible and vulnerable. I recall that I told the driver to stop short of the main entrance. I got out with a painful and deliberate slowness. I was going to the village of Ashgrove, but took a ticket for a station further on. The train would leave in a few minutes at 8:50. I hurried, for the next would not go until 9:30. There was almost no one on the platform. I walked through the carriages. I remember some farmers, a woman dressed in mourning, a youth deep in Tacitus and annals, and a wounded, happy soldier. At last the train pulled out. A man I recognized ran furiously but vainly the length of the platform. It was Captain Richard Madden. Shattered, trembling, I had died in the distant corner of the seat, as far as possible from the fearful window. Sorry, that was a poorly read sentence because of a hyphen. I apologize. Suddenly, shattered, trembling, I huddled in the distant corner of the seat, as far as possible from the fearful window. Not I had died. What a terrible misreading. Just didn't see that hyphen. At any rate, from utter terror, I passed into a state of almost abject happiness. I told myself that the duel had already started and that I had won the first encounter by besting my adversary in his first attack, even if it was only for 40 minutes, by an accident of fate. I argued that so small a victory prefigured a total victory. I argued that it was not so trivial, that were it not for the precious accident of the train schedule, I would be in prison or dead. I argued with no less sophism that my timorous happiness was proof that I was man enough to bring this adventure to a successful conclusion. From my weakness I drew strength that never left me. I foresee that man will resign himself each day to new abominations, that soon only soldiers and bandits will be left. To them I offer this advice. Whosoever would undertake some atrocious enterprise should act as if it were already accomplished, should impose upon himself a future as irrevocable as the past. Thus I proceeded, while with the eyes of a man already dead, I contemplated the fluctuations of the day which would probably be my last, and watched the diffuse coming of night. The train crept along gently, amid ash trees. It slowed down and stopped. Almost in the middle of a field. No one called the name of a station. Ashgrove, I asked some children on the platform. Ashgrove, they replied. I got out. A lamp lit the platform, but the children's faces remained in a shadow. One of them asked me, "Are you going to Dr. Stephen Albert's house?" Without waiting for my answer, another said, "The house is a good distance away, but you won't get lost if you take the road to the left and bear to the left at every crossroad." I threw them a coin, my last, went down some stone steps and started along a deserted road. At a slight incline, the road ran downhill. It was a plain dirt way, and overhead the branches of trees intermingled while a round moon hung low in the sky as if to keep me company. For a moment I thought that Richard Madden might in some way have divined my desperate intent. At once I realized that this would be impossible. The advice about turning always to the left reminded me that such was the common formula for finding the central courtyard of certain labyrinths. I know something about labyrinths. Not for nothing am I the great-grandson of Tsui Pen. He was governor of Yunnanari and gave up temporal power to write a novel with more characters than there are in the Hung Lu Meng, and to create a maze in which all men would lose themselves. He spent 13 years on these oddly assorted tasks before he was assassinated by a stranger. His novel had no sense to it, and nobody ever found his labyrinth. Under the trees of England, I meditated on this lost and perhaps mythical labyrinth. I imagined it untouched and perfect on the secret summit of some mountain. I imagined it drowned under rice paddies or beneath the sea. I imagined it infinite, made not only of eight-sided pavilions and of twisting paths, but also of rivers, provinces, and kingdoms. I thought of a maze of mazes, of a sinuous, ever-growing maze which would take in both past and future and would somehow involve the stars. Lost in these imaginary illusions, I forgot my destiny, that of the hunted. For an undetermined period of time, I felt myself cut off from the world, an abstract spectator. The hazy and murmuring countryside, the moon, the decline of the evening stirred within me. Going down the gently sloping road, I could not feel fatigue. The evening was at once intimate and infinite. The road kept descending and branching off through meadows, misty in the twilight. A high-pitched and almost syllabic music kept coming and going, moving with the breeze, blurred by the leaves and by distance. I thought that a man might be an enemy of other men, of the differing moments of other men, but never an enemy of a country, not of fireflies, words, gardens, streams, or the west wind. Meditating thus, I arrived at a high, rusty iron gate. Through the railings I could see an avenue, bordered with poplar trees and also a kind of summer house or pavilion. Two things dawned on me at once, the first trivial and the second almost incredible. The music came from the pavilion, and that music was Chinese. That was why I had accepted it fully, without paying it any attention. I do not remember whether there was a bell, a push button, or whether I attracted attention by clapping my hands. The stuttering sparks of the music kept on. But from the end of the avenue, from the main house, a lantern approached. A lantern which alternately, from moment to moment, was crisscrossed or put out by the trunks of the trees. A paper lantern, shaped like a drum and colored like the moon. A tall man carried it. I could not see his face, for the light blinded me. He opened the gate and spoke slowly in my language. I see that the worthy Si Peng has troubled himself to see to relieving my solitude. No doubt you want to see the garden. Recognizing the name of one of our consuls, I replied, somewhat taken aback, "The garden? The garden of forking paths." Something stirred in my memory, and I said with incomprehensible assurance, "The garden of my ancestor, Sui Pen." "Your ancestor? Your illustrious ancestor? Come in." The damp path zigzagged, like those of my childhood. When we reached the house, we went into a library filled with books from both east and west. I recognized some large volumes bound in yellow silk, manuscripts of the Lost Encyclopedia, which was edited by the third emperor of the Luminous Dynasty. They had never been printed. A phonograph record was spinning near a bronze phoenix. I remember also a rose-glazed jar, and yet another older, by many centuries, of that blue color which our potters copied from the Persians. Stephen Albert was watching me with a smile on his face. He was, as I have said, remarkably tall. His face was deeply lined, and he had gray eyes and a gray beard. There was about him something of the priest and something of the sailor. Later, he told me, he had been a missionary in Tianjin before he had, quote, aspired to become a sinologist, end quote. We sat down, high upon a large, low divan, he with his back to the window and to a large circular clock. I calculated that my pursuer, Richard Madden, could not arrive in less than an hour. My irrevocable decision could wait. "A strange destiny," said Stephen Albert, "that of Sui Pen, governor of his native province, learned in astronomy and astrology, and tireless in the interpretation of the canonical books, a chess player, a famous poet, a calligrapher, and yet he abandoned all to make a book and a labyrinth. He gave up all the pleasures of oppression, justice, of a well-stocked bed, banquets, and even of erudition, and shut himself up in the pavilion of the limpid sun for 13 years. At his death, his heirs found only a mess of manuscripts. The family, as you doubtless know, wished to consign them to the fire, but the executor of the estate, a Taoist or a Buddhist monk, insisted on their publication. Those of the blood of Sui Pen, I replied, still curse the memory of that monk. Such a publication was madness. The book is a shapeless mass of contradictory rough drafts. I examined it once upon a time. The hero dies in the third chapter, while in the fourth he is alive. As for that other enterprise of Sui Pen, his labyrinth. "Here is the labyrinth," Albert said, pointing to a tall, lacquered writing cabinet. An ivory labyrinth, I exclaimed. A tiny labyrinth indeed. A symbolic labyrinth, he corrected me. An invisible labyrinth of time. I, a barbarous Englishman, have been given the key to this transparent mystery. After more than 100 years, most of the details are irrecoverable, lost beyond all recall. But it isn't hard to image what must have happened. At one time, Tsui Pan must have said, I am going into seclusion to write a book. And at another, I am retiring to construct a maze. Everyone assumed these were separate activities. No one realized that the book and the labyrinth were one and the same. The pavilion of the limpid sun was set in the middle of an intricate garden. This may have suggested the idea of a physical maze. Tsui Pan died. In all the vast lands which once belonged to your family, no one could find the labyrinth. The novel's confusion suggested that it was the labyrinth. Two circumstances showed me the direct solution to the problem. First, the curious legend that Tsui Pan had proposed to create an infinite maze. Second, a fragment of a letter, which I discovered. Albert rose. For a few minutes, he turned his back to me. He opened the top drawer in the high, black, and gilded writing cabinet. He returned, holding in his hand a piece of paper, which had once been crimson, but which had faded with the passage of time. It was rose-colored, tenuous, quadrangular. Tsui Pan's calligraphy was justly famous. Eagerly, but without understanding, I read the words which a man of my own blood had written with a small brush. I leave to various future times, but not to all my garden of forking paths. I handed back the sheet of paper in silence. Albert went on. Before I discovered this letter, I kept asking myself how a book could be infinite. I could not imagine any other than a cyclic volume, circular, a volume whose last page would be the same as the first, and so have the possibility of continuing indefinitely. I recall, too, the night in the middle of the 1001 Nights, when Queen Shahrazad, through a magical mistake on the part of her copyist, started to tell the story of the 1001 Nights with the risk of again arriving at the night upon which she will relate it, and thus on to infinity. I also imagined a platonic hereditary work, passed on from father to son, to which each individual would add a new chapter or correct with pious care the work of his elders. These conjectures gave me amusement, but none seemed to have the remotest application to the contradictory chapters of Tsui Pan. At this point, I was sent from Oxford the manuscript you've just seen. Naturally, my attention was caught by the sentence, I leave to various future times, but not to all my garden of forking paths. I had no sooner read this than I understood the garden of forking paths was the chaotic novel itself. The phrase, to various future times, but not to all, suggested the image of bifurcating in time, not in space. Rereading the whole work confirmed this theory. In all fiction, when a man is faced with alternatives, he chooses one at the expense of the others. In the almost unfathomable Tsui Pan, he chooses simultaneously all of them. He thus creates various futures, various times which start others that will in their turn branch out and bifurcate in other times. This is the cause of the contradictions in the novel. Fang, let us say, has a secret. A stranger knocks at his door. Fang makes up his mind to kill him. Naturally, there are various possible outcomes. Fang can kill the intruder. The intruder can kill Fang. Both can be saved. Both can die. And so on, and so on. In Sui Pen's work, all the possible solutions occur, each one being the point of departure for other bifurcations. Sometimes the pathways of this labyrinth converge. For example, you come to this house, but in other possible pasts, you are my enemy. In others, my friend. If you will put up with my atrocious pronunciation, I would like to read you a few pages of your ancestor's work. His countenance in the bright circle of lamplight was certainly that of an ancient, but it shone with something unyielding, even immortal. With slow precision, he read two versions of the same epic chapter. In the first, an army marches into battle over a desolate mountain pass. The bleak and somber aspect of the rocky landscape made the soldiers feel that life itself was of little value, and so they won the battle easily. In the second, the same army passes through a palace where a banquet is in progress. The splendor of the feast remained a memory throughout the glorious battle, and so victory followed. With proper veneration, I listened to these old tales, although perhaps with less admiration for them and themselves than for the fact that they had been thought out by one of my own blood, and that a man of a distant empire had given them back to me in the last stage of a desperate adventure on a western island. I remember the final words repeated at the end of each version like a secret command. Thus the heroes fought with tranquil heart and a bloody sword. They were resigned to killing and to dying. At that moment, I felt within me and around me something invisible and intangible pullulating. It was not the pullulation of two divergent, parallel, and finally converging armies, but an agitation more inaccessible, more intimate, prefigured by them in some way. Stephen Albert continued. I do not think that your illustrious ancestor toyed idly with variations. I do not find it believable that he would waste 13 years laboring over a never-ending experiment in rhetoric. In your country, the novel is an inferior genre. In Sui Pen's period, it was a despised one. Sui Pen was a fine novelist, but he was also a man of letters who doubtless considered himself more than a mere novelist. The testimony of his contemporaries attest to this, and certainly the known facts of his life confirm the leanings toward the metaphysical and the mystical. Philosophical conjectures take up the greater part of his novel. I know that of all problems, none disquieted him more and none concerned him more than the profound one of time. Now then, this is the only problem that does not figure in the pages of the garden. He does not even use the word which means time. How can these voluntary emissions be explained? Omissions, not emissions. I proposed various solutions, all of them inadequate. We discussed them, and finally, Stephen Albert said, in a guessing game to which the answer is chess, which word is the only one prohibited? I thought for a moment and then replied, well, that word is chess. Precisely, said Albert, the garden of forking paths as an enormous guessing game, or parable, in which the subject is time. The rules of the game forbid the use of the word itself. To eliminate a word completely, to refer to it by means of inept phrases and obvious paraphrases is perhaps the best way of drawing attention to it. This, then, is the tortuous method of approach preferred by the oblique sweep pen in every meandering of his interminable novel. I have gone over hundreds of manuscripts. I have corrected errors introduced by careless copyists. I have worked out the plan from this chaos. I have restored, or believe I have restored, the original. I have translated the whole work. I can state categorically that not once has the word time been used in the whole book. The explanation is obvious. The Garden of Forking Paths is a picture, incomplete yet not false, of the universe, such as Sui Pen conceived it to be. Differing from Newton and Schopenhauer, your ancestor did not think of time as absolute and uniform. He believed in an infinite series of times, in a dizzily growing, ever-spreading network of diverging, converging, and parallel times. This web of time, the strands of which approach one another, bifurcate, intersect, or ignore each other through the centuries, embraces every possibility. We do not exist in most of them. In some you exist and not I, while in others I do and you do not, and yet others both of us exist. In this one, in which chance has favored me, you have come to my gate. In another, you, crossing the gardens, have found me dead. In yet another, I say these very same words, but I am an error, a phantom. In all of them, I enunciated with a tremor in my voice, I deeply appreciate and am grateful to you for the restoration of Sui Pen's garden. Not in all, he murmured with a smile. Time is forever dividing itself toward innumerable futures, and in one of them, I am your enemy. Once again, I sensed the pullulation of which I have already spoken. It seemed to me that the dew-damp garden surrounding the house was infinitely saturated with invisible people. All were Albert and myself, secretive, busy, and multiform in other dimensions of time. I lifted my eyes, and the short nightmares disappeared. In the black and yellow garden there was only a single man, but this man was as strong as a statue, and this man was walking up the path, and he was Captain Richard Madden. "The future exists now," I replied, "but I am your friend. Can I take another look at the letter?" Albert rose from his seat. He stood up tall as he opened the top drawer of the high writing cabinet, and for a moment his back was again turned to me. I had the revolver ready. I fired with the utmost care. Albert fell without a murmur at once. I swear that his death was instantaneous, as if he'd been struck by lightning. What remains is unreal and unimportant. Madden broke in and arrested me. I've been condemned to hang. Abominably, I have yet triumphed. The secret name of the city to be attacked got through to Berlin. Yesterday it was bombed. I read the news in the same English newspapers which were trying to solve the riddle of the murder of the learned sinologist Stephen Albert by the unknown Yutsun. The chief, however, had already solved this mystery. He knew that my problem was to shout with my feeble voice above the tumult of war the name of the city, called Albert, and that I had no other course open to me than to kill someone of that name. He does not know, for no one can, of my infinite penitence and sickness of the heart. The Garden of the Forking Paths. From a collection of stories called Ficciones by the author, I guess, late, great, Jorge Luis Borges of Argentina. This one translated by Helen Temple and Ruth Van Todd for the compilation of tales Ficciones, which was published quite a while ago. Now there's a new translation of Borges that I do not like, put out by Penguin and done by some guy named Hurley, I think it is. Apparently because his wife didn't like the translator, my namesake, Norman Thomas DiGiovanni, I think his name is. But yeah, she didn't like him. And I guess it's prevented all reproductions or reprints of this book. And it's just promoting the Hurley one, but I really don't like it. Anyway, what do I know? They're just translations. You're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM radio for open ears in the Hudson Valley, Hudson, Catskill, Acre, Cairo, New York. I guess I should just say Columbia and Greene Counties, and WGXC.org on the World Wide InfiWeb. All right, I'm going to retreat to finish out the show with one of my faves. This is from The Imaginary Lives of Marcel Schwab. It's called Herostratus. Incendiary. The city of Ephesus, the birthplace of Herostratus, sprawled from the mouth of the Caister with its two river ports all the way to the Quays of Panorama, from where one could see the foggy outline of Samos on the many-hued sea. It had been overflowing with gold and fine cloth, wool, and roses ever since the magnates, with their dogs of war and their spear-hurling slaves, had been defeated on the banks of the Meander, ever since the magnificent Miletus had been left in ruins by the Persians. It was an indolent city where the courtesans were celebrated in the temple of Aphrodite Hetera. The Ephesians wore transparent Amorgina tunics, robes of wheel spun linen, the color of violets, murex, and saffron. Serapes, the color of yellow apples, or white, or pink. Fabrics from Egypt, the color of hyacinth, that blazed with flame in the shifting shades of the sea. And calasiris from Persia, fashioned from light, closely woven fabric, their deepest scarlet studded with beads of gold. Between Mount Prion and a tall steep cliff on the bank of the Caister stood the great temple of Artemis. Its construction had taken 120 years. Austere paintings adorned its interior rooms. Its ceiling was of ebony and cypress. The heavy columns holding it aloft had been smeared with minium. The chamber of the goddess was small and oval in shape. In the center stood a stone of the most remarkable blackness, conical and gleaming, marked with lunar gildings. This was none other than Artemis herself. The triangular altar was also carved of black stone. Other tables made of black slabs were pierced by regular holes through which would flow the blood of the victims. From the walls hung wide steel blades, hefted with gold and used to open throats. And the polished parquet was strewn with blood-darkened bandages. The great dark stone had two hard and pointed breasts. Such was the Artemis of Ephesus. Her divinity had been lost in the night among the Egyptian tombs, and one had to worship her according to the rites of the Persians. She possessed treasures which were enclosed in a hive-like object painted in green, the pyramidal door of which was barbed with nails of bronze. There, among the rings, the abundance of coins and rubies rested the manuscript of Heraclitus, who had proclaimed the reign of fire. The philosopher himself had deposited it at the base of the pyramid during the temple's construction. Herostratus' mother was violent and haughty. The identity of his father was unknown. Later, Herostratus would declare that he was the son of the flames. His body bore the mark below the left breast of a crescent, which appeared to burn with fire when he was tortured. Those who were present at his birth foretold that he would forever be bound to Artemis. He was wrathful and remained a virgin. His face was worn away by faint lines, and his skin was of a dark shade for that region. From childhood he enjoyed standing beneath the tall cliff, the Artemision. He would watch the processions of offerings pass by. Owing to the ignorance as to his race, he was not permitted to become a priest of the goddess to whom he thought himself devoted. On several occasions, the sacerdotal college was forced to forbid him entry to the mass, within which he longed to pull aside the lavish and weighty cloth that concealed Artemis. He conceived a hatred for them and vowed that he would have the secret for himself at any cost. The name Herostratus seemed to him to be unlike that of any other, much as he felt himself to be superior to any other man. He longed for fame, first he aligned himself with the philosophers who taught the doctrines of Heraclitus, but then But they knew nothing of all the most secret of the great philosopher's thinking. As his words were enclosed in the little pyramid-shaped vessel that contained Artemis's treasure, Herostratus could only conjecture as to the master's true sentiments. He hardened himself against the wealth that surrounded him. His distaste for the love of the courtesans was extreme. Some felt he was saving his virginity for the goddess, and yet Artemis did not show him the least bit of mercy. To the Jerusian council he seemed dangerous, and he was carefully observed from the temple. The satrap agreed to banish him beyond the city walls. So he lived on the slopes of Corissos, in a small cave dug by the ancients. From there he kept watch at night over the sacred lanterns of the Artemision. Some say that enlightened Persians came there to deliberate with him. However, it is more likely that his destiny was revealed to him all at once. Indeed, during torture, he admitted that he had, all of a sudden, come to understand the meaning of the words of Heraclitus, the upward path, as well as the reason the philosopher had taught that the best soul is that which is both the dirtiest, the driest, and burns the hottest. He testified that his own soul, according to this definition, was the most perfect of all, that he had wanted to announce that fact. He gave no reason for his actions other than a passion for glory and the joy of hearing his own name shouted out by others. He said that only his reign could be absolute, since no one knew a thing of his father, and because Herostratus had been crowned by Herostratus. He was the son of his own accomplishment, and a work that was the very essence of the world. Accordingly, he alone among men could have been at once king, philosopher, and god. In the year 356, on the night of the 21st of July, the moon still not having climbed into the sky, the desires of Herostratus having taken on a rare intensity, he resolved to penetrate the secret chamber of Artemis. Thus he crept, zigzagging his way along the mountain as far as the shore of the Caister, and he scaled the steps of the temple. The priest guards slept next to the holy lanterns, and Herostratus grabbed one of these up and entered the nave. A strong odor of nard oil radiated from within. The black ribs of the ebony ceiling were dazzling. The chamber's oval shape was divided by a curtain woven from threads of gold and purple which concealed the goddess. Herostratus, panting out of sheer delight, tore it away. His lamp illuminated the terrible cone with its erect breasts. Herostratus seized them in both hands and greedily embraced the divine stone. Then he turned and caught sight of the green pyramid where the treasure was kept. He grasped the brass nails of the little door and forced it loose. He plunged his fingers into the virgin gemstones, but he took only the roll of papyrus upon which Heraclitus had inscribed his words. By the light of the sacred lamp, he read them, and all was understood. Straightway he cried out, "It's fire! Fire!" He pulled Artemis's curtain toward him and brought the burning work of his lamp to its lower section. The cloth burned slowly at first, and then, because of vapors of the perfumed oil with which it had been imbued, the flame climbed, burning blue, toward the ebony paneling. The terrible cone reflected the flames. The fire wound its way up to the column tops, slithered along the vaulted arches. One by one, with a great metallic clanging, the golden plates honoring the powerful Artemis fell from where they had been suspended to the stone slabs below. Then the quick burning sheaves on the rooftop burst into flames, illuminating the cliffside. The bronze tiles collapsed to the ground. Herostratus stood in the glow, shouting his own name into the night. The entire Artemision was a red mass at the center of the darkness. The guards seized the criminal. He had to be gagged to prevent him from yelling out his own name. He was cast into the dungeon, bound for what remained of the blaze. At once, Artaxerxes sent the order for him to be tortured. He would not admit anything beyond that which has been said. The 12 cities of Ionia forbade anyone on pain of death from passing the name Herostratus on to future generations. And yet, whispers have carried it along through time, all the way to us. The night Herostratus set alight the temple of Ephesus was the same night that brought Alexander, the king of Macedon, into the world. You've been listening to Good Night, Norman. It is Monday, March 17th. It's to some St. Patrick's Day. WGXC 90.7 FM is community radio. Based here in Hudson, Catskill. Offices in Catskill on Main Street. And Tower in Akron, New York. Wavefarm.org is the umbrella org for the radio station. And you can join. Always looking for volunteer programmers and your donations. Of which I don't get a penny directly, but I think we all kind of get a penny here and there. You've been listening to me, your host, Norman Douglas. Name of the show, Good Night, Norman. And with only a few minutes to go, I'm loath to start reading another story. And then what should I do instead? I don't know. Last week I went on a diatribe. But I don't really feel like that. That was just impatience. Someone asked me to read this, which will be nowhere near finished by the time the broadcast ends, but tune in 2 weeks. I doubt I'll be reading this, but anyways. This is untitled. It's called I'm Writing a Story. It's not called anything. I'm writing a story that takes place a couple thousand years from now in the year 6731, using the Chinese calendar instead of the Christian calendar, because 2,000 years from now, both Christ and China no longer function in ways akin to how they function in the 21st century CE. No one in 6731 knows how or why there are only brown people, because the whole history of the world as we think we know it is not the history of the world in 6731. No one in 6731 questions what happened to the world of 2025, because the way I see it now is that we've already forgotten the history of things as they are, let alone 1,000 years ago. And that probably won't change much in the years to come, except to become even more true than it is now. Of course, all that people do or did and likely will ever do is tell stories, and all stories are fictions, history included. Facts are mere translations of symbols we notice, personas, pattern recognitions, or lack thereof, definitions reinvented by the perceiver of what they purport to perceive. In fact, everything is fiction. I mean, if I could get everybody I know to write down or tell me what happened yesterday, there would be as many different stories as people writing. Cutting and pasting all of them into one story won't change this. Which one is true? So, in 6731, when Raina visits old friend Riven, pursuing... When Raina visits her old friend Riven in the Eureka Preserve to do research, that starts the real action. What they dig up reveals the fragments of a story that credits a scrappy group of 21st century street poets, storytellers, and public intellects with fomenting a long simmering and suddenly brimming people's movement that ushers in the foundations for 6731's long-standing culture. But the unnerving details of this 21st century story upset the timeless framework enjoyed by many of the 46th century CE, actually the 66th century XE. While symptoms of the Anthropocene and the future Ecocene are portrayed, satirized as well as esteemed within the action, the upshot is a sweeping rendition of utopia as viable fiction versus the host of uncomfortable fictions that serve as fixations for many of those in our current day. I'm going to wish you a good night. I'm going to tell you to tune in again for more fiction next time. Is it 2 weeks from tonight? It might not be.